This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Alyssa Block. Imagine the nearest supermarket is miles away. You have no car. When you shop, you have two options: a bus ride to the market, where you buy only what you can carry, or you buy your groceries at the nearest convenience store. These so-called food deserts are common across the country. We're going to hear now about one community in East Los Angeles in a food desert, a community that's fighting for change. NPR's Mondalit Del Barco reports.
Other parts of the city have organic farmers markets and natural food emporiums, but Olga Bettis says her housing project, Ramona Gardens, is isolated from all that, surrounded by freeways, train tracks, and industrial warehouses.
From here, you look all around, there's no market, nowhere right here. Nowhere right there, nowhere anywhere around this area.
Unlike some other low-income neighborhoods, there's no glut of burger joints or taco trucks, not even any liquor stores selling milk and bread. Bettis found out how the other half lives during a recent trip to upscale Santa Monica, where she visited a local supermarket.
The apples, the strawberries, the vegetables, the squash, everything. I wanted so bad to just bite the fruit right then and there as soon as I seen it. I almost got cut because I got a strawberry and I was going to bite it.
Bettis says the one-time trip was a revelation.
It really opened my eyes and made me see the difference of, I didn't even know there was markets out there like that, and I didn't know there was organic food. I never even knew what that was.
Ramona Gardens is in a neighborhood that's never been able to attract a big supermarket for two reasons. People who live here don't have much money, and the area has a reputation for gang violence. People here depend on a lone convenience store, where Betta says the choices are limited. The food is costly and often out of date.
I've bought sour cream that was all green inside. I bought a gallon of orange juice that was green on the, as soon as I opened the lid, all the inside of the lid was green with fur. You know what I mean? And I've bought Rice-A-Roni, and when I opened the box, there was maggots in there. I would get angry because it happened so many times.
Kareem Raza is one of two managers for the market.
They're saying that the food here is bad.
The food? No, I don't think so. Right now you can check nothing. Nothing is bad now.
Manager Lori Ruiz agrees the market charges more than supermarket chains, but she says they have to.
And the big markets, they always have like a promotion and a special prices because they buy for a big amount. They buy by a pallet, and we don't buy by a pallet because we don't sell that much.
Amazingly, the neighborhood has no farmers market, just one local street vendor who brings a few fresh fruits and vegetables. But residents like Betta say he comes during the day when they're at work. She depends on the nearest supermarket, which is a bus ride away. At the Superior grocery store, Bettis explains she has better choices, but she can only buy what she can carry back home in her arms.
And right here, looking for a dollar, the macaroni. That's what really kills me, is when there's a special and I can't get it. I have to get one single carton, even if it costs more, because of the weight.
It's a tough situation. USC professor Cheryl Resnick runs a weekly free clinic for Ramona Gardens families. She says their poor food choices are taking a toll. Hypertension, early onset diabetes, and obesity.
I had to buy a scale that goes up to 500 pounds because we had three children come in that exceeded the 250-pound weight limit of our clinic scale. So when you have a 9-year-old who weighs 150, and when you have a 14-year-old that weighs over 250, you know you have a problem.
Now Olga Bettis and some of her neighbors are speaking out and lobbying politicians to help them get healthier food options. They won a small victory when Superior Grocery Store District Manager Marco Sosa brought back free shuttle van rides for customers, something he dropped last year because of cost.
As long as they spend $40 of shopping, they'll qualify to get into the van.
Betta says the shuttle is a good thing, but just a partial solution. Her goal is to have a real supermarket in Ramona Gardens. She wants something better for herself, her neighbors, and her family.
It doesn't matter if we live in a small, low-income area. You know, we all deserve to eat the fresh fruits that nature provided for us. You know, that we shouldn't be divided.
Mondalit Del Barco, NPR News.
More than 6 million Americans have been out of work for at least 6 months. Hunting for a new job can be a demoralizing process, the resumes, the cold calls, but there are strategies that work. Here's NPR's Wendy Kaufman with some tips.
Matt Youngquist, the president of Career Horizons, sees lots of people who've lost their job. He tells them finding a job presents the same challenges as taking a product to market, but the product they're marketing is themselves.
First, you got to know what you're selling and to whom. Then you've got to package it up properly. And then you get into kind of that execution phase.
Los Angeles area resident Terry Garfinkel didn't waste much time after being let go from her job at a high-end retail bakery. She cried, drove home, and then opened her laptop.
And the first thing I did was check my employer files. And I keep pretty good records of everywhere I've worked. And I went through the list and sent out emails to any of my ex-employers I felt I would want to work for again and let them know that I was available and looking.
Her effort paid off. She was hired for a direct sales job by someone she had worked for just briefly a decade ago. Most people still hunt for jobs primarily by looking at the posted offerings. Websites like Indeed.com and Simply Hired make searching easier. But just sending out resumes, even hundreds of resumes in response to ads, probably won't get you very far. Because, as career coach Matt Youngquist explains, most jobs aren't posted or advertised publicly.
At least 70%, if not 80% of jobs are not published. And yet most people, they're spending 70 or 80% of their time surfing the net versus getting out there, talking to employers, taking some chances, realizing that the vast majority of hiring is friends and acquaintances hiring other trusted friends and acquaintances.
But what if you don't know anyone who works in a company you're interested in? Youngquist suggests using the people search page on the networking site LinkedIn to find people who could put you in touch with a hiring manager. That personal connection is especially important now. With so many people applying for jobs, it's hard to get noticed. How hard? We asked Ashley Stirrup.
You typically see about 6 times the number of applications as you have employees in a company. So for a 30,000 employee company, that would be 180,000 applications a year.
That's right. 180,000 applicants. Stirrup isn't making these numbers up. The company he works for, Taleo, is a leading provider of software that companies use to sift through job applications.
I remember it was kind of an intimidating scene.
Former pharmaceutical sales rep Camilo Ruan recalls one third round interview he had last year. He was on one side of a hotel conference room table. Several of the firm's hiring managers were on the other.
And I just remember looking at the stack of resumes, and it was about 60, 70 resumes that they had on there, and they had, two positions open.
He didn't get that job, but landed what he describes as a great one as an account executive at the international package delivery company TNT Express. He even makes more money now than he did before.
I would say the smartest thing that I did was look at the job hunt as the job itself.
He'd get up early and every day make 6, 7, even 8 contacts, phone calls, customized emails with resumes and cover letters that focused not on past performance but on the future. He used his knowledge of a company and its products to highlight what he could do for them. And yes, job seekers, cover letters do matter. As for how many contacts a job seeker should be making, Youngquist says 100 a month is a bare minimum.
It takes X number of contacts to get this many appointments, to get this many chances of actually getting a sales opportunity or a job. I do think volume is a big part of it, and a lot of people, their efforts are just really anemic.
And he adds, there are more jobs out there than many people think, but you have to be smart and disciplined about finding them. Wendy Kaufman, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Renee Montaigne. This is the time of year when students are wondering if they'll be accepted to the college of their choice. Many colleges and universities are asking themselves another question. How can we hold on to students once they're enrolled? Some schools see half their freshman class leave. NPR's Larry Abramson reports that some schools are trying to keep students coming back with a new twist on a familiar tool, social networking.
Last fall, these students were psyched to be starting school at Coppin State University in Baltimore, but if history is any guide, 40% of them will disappear before next year, victims of this school's low retention rate. To address this problem, some schools build physical spaces, new dorms with themes and clubs to make sure new students get involved. Those strategies can help, but the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation has been looking for new approaches. Today, the foundation is announcing it will invest $2 million in a company that's trying to build virtual college communities. Michael Staten is president of Integral, which builds school-based Facebook sites.
What we do is make sure that when students arrive, they either already have assembled or very quickly assemble that kind of peer support.
Peer support means a ready network of friends. Only students can gain entry to these sites, and they're invited in the moment they're accepted to a school. The feel is supposed to be small and intimate, unlike schools' fan sites on Facebook, which are open to everyone and don't inspire much networking. Columbia College, an arts and media school in Chicago, has been experimenting with a site. Samantha Sayazonza, a sophomore in journalism there, says it helps her merge her social and academic lives.
Actually check to see who's in my class and what their schedule's going to look like. That's really my favorite thing to do.
School clubs can use this technology to recruit and discuss campus issues. The sites are there for students, not for administrators. Schools pay what they say is a nominal fee for Integral to build a site. The hope is that they will get paid back through greater student engagement and higher retention rates. That saves them money in the long run because they don't have to replace all those dropouts. Carrie Barlow has been in charge of Arizona State's experiment with the Schools app.
Yeah, we have some indication that first-time freshmen who opted to participate in the application were highly more likely to be retained for the next semester.
It will be tough to show whether these efforts played any direct role in students' decision to stay or go. That's a subject for future research. And, of course, many students are out of reach of this and other approaches. Alexis Thompson, a sophomore who uses Columbia College's site, says it only works if kids work with it.
That's something that they have to be proactive about. So the Facebook app can be there, but unless you're being proactive and you want to go out and look for things like that, it's really on the student.
The Gates Foundation investment seems to show that the organization is casting a wide net to find new ideas that will improve outcomes in higher education. This is the first time that the nonprofit foundation has bought an actual equity stake in a for-profit company. Larry Abramson, NPR News, Washington.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. Good morning. I'm Renee Montagne.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. The President of the United States can sign billions of dollars of tax cuts into law and approve trillions of dollars in spending, but sometimes the smaller initiatives make a big difference. In a moment, we'll explore the way the President speaks to business.
We will start with the First Lady and her initiative. Michelle Obama is marking the first anniversary of her Let's Move project. Her goal is to reduce childhood obesity. NPR's Ari Shapiro tells us how it's going.
The idea of a sustained project for the First Lady started in the early 1960s.
It was Jacqueline Kennedy's work on refurbishing the White House, and that sort of set a bar early on.
Dr. Myra Gutten of Rider University in New Jersey studies the history of First Ladies.
First Ladies generally are dealing with less controversial or uncontroversial issues, but those which tend to benefit many people in the country.
Lady Bird Johnson focused on highway beautification. Rosalind Carter addressed mental health. Barbara Bush took on literacy. And in that respect, Gutten says the Let's Move initiative is right in line with what others have done. But she says Michelle Obama goes farther than her predecessors.
She has partners from Major League Baseball to Walmart. And no other First Lady initiative that I can think of had that kind of support from the corporate world.
I am thrilled about Walmart's new nutrition charter.
Last month, the First Lady joined Walmart executives to announce that the grocery chain will reduce sugar, sodium, and trans fats in thousands of its products. The month before that, she persuaded Congress to pass a $4.5 billion child nutrition bill. At the signing ceremony, the president credited his wife with giving the bill the urgency it needed to become a law.
Had I not been able to get this passed, I would be sleeping on the couch.
Dr. Marion Nessel is a professor of nutrition, food studies, and public health at NYU. She says the First Lady has moved what used to be a niche movement into the mainstream.
There's no question that there are enormous changes taking place in school lunches.
You can see that all over the country, where schools everywhere are trying to do something to improve the quality of the food that they're serving to children. So this is having an immediate impact.
The First Lady rarely misses an opportunity to plug this program. Guests who are invited to the White House for a meal will often read that ingredients on the menu come from the White House garden. Even the president's Super Bowl party, on top of the kielbasa and buffalo wings, included White House honey ale. Yesterday, Mrs. Obama held conference calls to thank mayors, school officials, and medical professionals who have been involved in the program.
It's pretty amazing, for me at least, to look back and see how far we've come.
Surgeon General Regina Benjamin said there is no greater challenge to the country's health than obesity.
Since 1980, obesity rates have doubled in adults and more than tripled in children. And the problem is even worse among Black, Hispanic, and Native American children.
It helps that kids' nutrition has historically been a bipartisan issue. 5 years ago, Democrat Bill Clinton and Republican Mike Huckabee teamed up on a childhood obesity program. Now that the White House is steering the ship, some Republicans have jumped overboard. Glenn Beck, Rush Limbaugh, and Sarah Palin have all attacked Mrs. Obama's program directly.
Instead of a government thinking that they need to take over, make decisions for us according to some politician or politician's wife priorities, just leave us alone, get off our back.
During the Super Bowl telecast, viewers in Washington, D.C. saw an ad against a proposed soda tax that struck a similar tone without mentioning Mrs. Obama's program specifically.
Give me a break. I can decide what to buy without government help. The government is just getting too involved in our personal lives.
While the critics accuse the program of being too heavy-handed, many of these changes come from agreements rather than regulations. No surprise, the First Lady favors carrots over sticks, and also carrots over Twinkies. Now that her team has made advances getting healthier foods into public schools and grocery stores, they are working on the next frontier, more nutritious options in restaurants. Ari Shapiro, NPR News, The White House.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Alyssa Block.
And I'm Robert Siegel. This weekend, millions of sports fans across Europe will be fixated on a rural, sparsely populated stretch of northern Maine. Aroostook County is hosting two biathlon World Cup events. Biathlon is wildly popular in Europe. Here in America, not so much. That is starting to change, though, as Jay Field reports from Maine Public Radio.
So some people listening might not know what biathlon is. Basically, it combines two sports near and dear to citizens in rural states that get a ton of snow: cross-country skiing and hunting. Though in biathlon, no one is shooting at deer or grouse.
With this 22 caliber rifles, they're quite sensitive for the wind.
Per Nilsson coaches the U.S. national team. He's watching his athletes take target practice at the Nordic Heritage Center in Presque Isle, Maine. In biathlon, skiers race around a cross-country track at breakneck speed, up hills, around sharp bends, down corkscrews, and into the shooting range.
Then you come in with a heart rate about 180, and in 30 seconds you should be down to the mat, take off the rifle, take your five shots, rifle on, and then away.
As you probably figured out, Nilsson isn't American. He's from Sweden, where kids grow up idolizing biathletes, the way youth here look up to Kobe or LeBron. Nilsson was recruited to put U.S. biathlon on the map, in part by working with promising U.S. athletes like Sarah Studebaker.
The Nordic culture in Europe and Scandinavia especially is huge, and we don't have that as much here, but I think it's definitely growing in popularity.
An estimated 130 million Europeans are expected to tune in live to the races on five broadcast networks. Here in the U.S., you can watch a live video stream of the events on the web. Organizers were planning for more than 35,000 spectators to travel to northern Maine to watch the competition. Thousands of screaming fans rang cowbells in the cold at the first set of races. They got a special treat when Sarah Studebaker, who grew up cross-country skiing in Boise, Idaho, came in 14th in the women's sprint. That's the best finish for an American woman in 7 years. Back in 1999, the nonprofit Maine Winter Sports Center set out to make Aroostook a leading site for Nordic sports. The county, as locals call it, has a rolling landscape built with potato farms and increasingly wind turbines. In the winter, snowmobiling has traditionally been the major economic engine, but Nordic sports are making an impact. Aroostook now has two world-class biathlon venues and skiing programs for adults and kids are now running in nearly 100 communities across Maine.
It's definitely a lot bigger than I expected it to be.
Jacob Toll, a high school junior, is one of hundreds of kids of all ages who took field trips to watch the races. Teachers in Aroostook County have incorporated the biathlon into their curriculum.
I just can't imagine all the hard work and everything they put in to actually get to this level.
Toll has at least some idea. He competes in both Nordic and Alpine events on his high school ski team. Biathlon may not overtake the NBA or NFL anytime soon, but as more people like Toll stay with the sport, it may mean the U.S. will eventually win a World Cup race. For NPR News, I'm Jay Field.